Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You don't think that it's time that somebody cared enough to have a dream?
Why are you getting so upset? This is not about you.
Yes, it is. You are a human affront to all women, and I am a woman.
At some point, you gotta decide for yourself who you are. Can't let nobody make that decision for you.
How do you go about getting an exorcism?
I beg your pardon?
Hi, thanks for downloading this edition of Kermode on Film. This week, I'm thrilled to be joined by Julian Temple, director of The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, Absolute Beginners, The Filth and the Fury, Oil City Confidential, Glastonbury, and now Ibiza the Silent Movie. Now, a few years ago, Julian came to the Shetland Film Festival, which I co-curate, and there he bravely took part in the Shetland Swim Challenge, which I made up, and which involves throwing yourself into ice-cold sea waters on both sides of the beach tombola at St Ninian's Isle. Julian absolutely aced the challenge and lived to tell the tale, and now he's made Ibiza the Silent Movie. To make the movie, Julian Temple teamed up with Fatboy Slim himself, Norman Cook, and we'll hear from Norman Cook in a while. But first, here's Julian Temple.
You like a challenge, right? You're never somebody who's shied away from a challenge.
I like to do something that hasn't been done before.
Okay, on the subject of which, you're here, we're here in BAFTA, because we're about to have a screening of your film, Ibiza the Silent Movie. And I love the fact that it's called Ibiza the Silent Movie, which, you know, seems like an inherent contradiction. For those who haven't seen it, which is everybody, because it's going to premiere at Glastonbury in a couple of weeks' time.
Cinerama Geddon.
Yes.
Biggest screen in Europe.
What? Is it actually the biggest
screen? It's a drive-in movie theatre. The only place you can have one in Britain is Glastonbury, because no one gives about the mud or the... Whatever the weather, they're happy. So a drive-in works there. The cars are already parked there. It's like they've been rusting there for like 70 years.
It's got kind of Mad Max vibe, yeah?
Yeah, it's Buicks kind of half buried in the landscape. It's Joe Rush, the art piece, you know, kind of. But the biggest screen in Europe, and you can watch great movies throughout the Glastonbury Festival. Fuck the music. Movies.
And how do you do the sound?
It's actually silent disco, but it's 7.3, you know, amazing sound. You can turn it up as loud as you want yourself as well.
So you've basically got people sitting in sort of burned out car shells watching on this massive screen with perfect sound because they've got headsets on, but it's silent.
Yes.
Okay, so tell us what Ibiza the Silent Movie is. Describe it, because, as I said, when I saw the title, I thought, I love that. I love the kind of contradiction, because it's about Ibiza in the history and how we've developed clubs.
It's the loudest silent movie ever made.
But then, of course, silent cinema was never silent, as you know.
Exactly. My father, my grandfather, went bankrupt in 1931, probably 1929, but he ran Silent Movie Orchestra Empire in the west of England, down to Penzance from Bristol, basically. And overnight, when the talkies came in, it was all over for his orchestra empire. And it could have been different growing up, I guess, if that hadn't happened. But
so I have a visceral, in your blood.
Yeah, in my brain, yeah.
Okay, so describe Ibiza the Silent Movie for us.
Well, I was asked by Malcolm Geary, who's here tonight, he's a great guy that we both know, would I want to do a film about Ibiza? And I was like, I'm not sure about that. It's not my kind of scene. I'd been there in the 80s with this weird guy who called Enigma. I don't know if you remember, there was a band called Enigma, but it was actually one guy sitting on a quarter of a Ibiza. He owned a quarter of a Ibiza. And he's since been thrown out for soaring down a mountain. But anyway, that's when I first
only
saw it. And I'd never been back. And so I had to think kind of, I know there's lots of stuff about the clubbing and but the island, when I was there, there's something about the number of influences that have come through that island, because it's just in the middle of the Mediterranean. It's been, you know, washed over by the Phoenicians, the Romans, the Moors. And I was thinking, if I could make a story for the clubbers to go and respect a little bit more the place they go to and have a great time, but they don't really understand this place. I wanted to tell through the music, you know, which involves jazz of the beatniks in the 50s and the hippie psychedelic guitar music of the 60s. It's not just the clubbing music, but tell the story of the island just kind of floating on a kind of a power-fueled carpet of music, you know.
You, at the beginning
and
of the
get rid of dipping the music, because, you know, every movie you have to make, dialogue in any kind of movie, the, whatever other sounds have to unnaturally go down.
Yeah.
So this was an opportunity to do something where the sound and the mix was incredibly free and told the story just with this impetus of sound, you know.
And the way you do that is you use silent movie intertitles, so the story is told through intertitles and through music and through this kind of collage of, you know, drama and documentary that is very, very Julian Temple.
Yeah, I don't see a division between the two. I mean, I think the best movies are feel real, and the best documentaries feel fake. So I'm somewhere in the middle there. I just love the sense that you can take an island, which is, you know, wrapped in myth. It loves a good story that didn't actually happen at Nibitha. You know, the Cream wrote that famous Ulysses song, Tales of Brave Ulysses, because Martin Sharp, you know, who did the wonderful Dylan poster, a psychedelic artist, told them that he had a house there, and on Esvedra, the island off the coast, that's where the sirens called him to his doom, you know. And so they went away and wrote a song, which becomes a kind of mythic truth about the island. But it's there's so many instances of Hannibal was born there, Christopher Columbus was born there. It loves to shroud itself in myth. So to me, that's also very interesting to look at the past and accept that any recreation of the past, whether it's Kirk Douglas, High Camp, 50s, or El Cid with Charlton, you know, they're all completely fake versions of the past you're getting in any movie, whether it's Ken Loach or Anthony Mann. It's not real. It's all in the imagination. And to play with that was also a great thing about the whirlpool of Ibiza, you know.
And at the very beginning of the film, you kind of start with, like, literally like a geographical history of how this island occurred, actually sort of split between two separate cultures, two different continents. We get this kind of, because you use animation to tell the story as well. And I mean, I don't think I'd ever really understood just how critically placed culturally Ibiza is.
Oh, it's right there on the crossroads of Africa, the Levant, you know, the Middle East, the Western Europe, France and Northern Europe. You know, it's perfectly there. And it's only 90 miles from Algiers, you know, it's closer to Algiers than Barcelona. So, yeah, in the history of, you know, civilization as it emerged, it was a very key place to control those trade routes. And, I mean, I found, one of the most interesting things I found about Ibiza was that the first people to go there in the way we kind of conceive of it now as a kind of slightly bohemian spiritual place were the Dada artists from Berlin, you know, when they had to get out of Berlin when Hitler was, you know, on their tail. Ibiza was the most remote, the poorest part of Europe. Really, literally. In the 50s, there were only 30 cars on the island. Mm-hmm. Now there are more cars per capita than anywhere else on the planet. So this little island in the last 50 years has gone through some kind of time warp catapulting into the future to do with tourism, which is also a very important subject in our modern times, I think. You know, what tourism does to places. I mean, people who can you know, people who live in Bath can tell you what it does to places, but Ibiza has had it more heavily than it's been tourist bombed ever since Franco got the idea of making it a tourist destination.
Yeah. This is a subject that the documentary deals with, that there is this kind of hedonistic paradise which draws beatniks and hippies and idealists, and yet it's sanctioned by the most repressive state imaginable.
In
and
Europe,
the film
yeah.
sort of, that's a kind of central irony of, you know, like, can you, did you always know that? Was that something that you discovered through
I didn't
research?
Know that. I knew Torre Molinos was important to Franco in terms of setting up, you know, or getting out of the UN boycott that he had from licking Hitler's ass a few years before, but he also set up Ibiza at the same time. So the first incarnation of Ibiza as a mass tourist destination was very like Torremolinos. It was like bad food, sewage straight into the bay, you know. But it was, you know, coincided with the availability of tourists on jet planes to go anywhere in Europe. So this remote Three Donkey Island that the Dada artists had fallen in love with, because it was like not just visiting ruins of the ancient world, it was like visiting a living version of the ancient world, and was probably the only place in Europe where that was possible. It was so remote and so unchanged. You know, it was suddenly thrown into this modern world, and people, you know, understandably realized they could get out of poverty this way. So the last 50 years of Ibiza is this incredible exponential, you know, farmhouses that they couldn't, were falling down, and now, you know, renting for 200,000 grand a week, you know, so it's a weird dynamic. It's a kind of supernova of tourism that's invented, you know, nocturnal tourism, drug tourism, all these new forms of tourism come out of this small island. So it's a fascinating story to investigate.
There's also one really bizarre detail that you point out at one moment when the tourism has really taken off on the coast, that there are still on Ibiza farmers in the middle of the island who've never seen the sea. And this idea, the idea that I think runs all the way through the documentary, it's almost like two different time periods are living cheek by jowl.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's the core of the film, really, is how much do you need to get paid to give up what your culture is? And there is a limit. And I think people in Ibiza are suddenly aware that, you know, shit, we've sold everything. We've sold not just the farm, we've sold our souls. And maybe it's all going to Mykonos next year, you know, the DJs. So what have we got left, you know? I mean, there's ironies upon ironies in the island, partly because it's, you know, the first world kind of connecting to other worlds, you know, and thinking there's this sense when you go to Ibiza that you're not going to a foreign country, it's clubland, you know, which is quite weird.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
What is your relationship with club culture? Because obviously, you know, we sort of first started to see your film work around the time of punk, and, you know, you've done numerous brilliant music documentaries, from Great Rock and Roll Swindle to the fantastic documentary you did about Wilco Johnson recently, and then you know worked with Suggs in his show. So what is your... I never thought of you as a sort of... as a clubbing... an EDM enthusiast, were you?
I think you're right. I was a fan of house music. You know, again, that connected to Detroit. We were talking about that. I think in any genre of music, if people like it, there's going to be 5% of it that's really actually pretty good, and the rest is shit. Whether that's guitar music, EDM, I don't know, but, you know, dance-driven, beat-driven, electronic music. But, you know, I'm just interested in music that has some kind of soul and connects emotionally. Ironically, I spent weeks roving Ibiza clubs looking for someone who danced to the music, and all they're doing is swaying slightly on some ketamine thing with a phone in their hand, you know, staring at a DJ. So there's not much dancing going on in these clubs anymore. When I first went there, it was a kind of weird hybrid of punk and hippie, and you know, it was the end of the 80s, and I think in the movie you do get the sense there was a, you know, kind of abandon to this dancing under the stars outside.
Yeah. Well, that seems to be closer to the kind of, you know, Wigan Casino, Northern Soul sort of dance experience.
Yeah,
that
yeah.
kind of, you know.
It was taking it to a Mediterranean, you know, balmy night, wonderful magic place, you know. But the same beautiful energy of Northern Soul and you know, dance culture is nothing new. It's from the beginning of time, you know. So, it was a great thing, I think, at a certain point to, you know, coming out of that whole history of the beatniks and the Dada guys and the hippies, to have these celebrations to dance to under the fucking moon and stars, you know.
Yeah. And in the film, the sort of the embodiment of dance is played by Bez.
Yeah, I didn't know that, actually, that Ibiza was named for their god of dance, who was called Bez.
Which just seems too perfect. And actually, I have to say, because at the beginning of the film, there's a thing which says loads of things that you hear about Ibiza are lies. And when it turned out that Ibiza was, I thought, Julian has to be making this up. No?
No, that's you know, the beauty of flipping truth and fiction on its head. That is real.
It's really
the
true.
Nostradamus quote at the beginning is fake, but they quote it as Bible on the island.
And the Nostradamus quote is the thing about when all civilization ends,
the final refuge on earth will be Ibiza. So that's accepted as true.
But it's not.
No. But the Bez thing is. So as far as we know, you know. But yes, it is.
And how did Bez feel when you told him?
Well, I told him you also got to keep your trainers on, because this is a fake, you know, it's like the wristwatch on the Roman soldier. It was like, what? He didn't have trainers in those days. No, he said he loved it. He didn't know either.
But that must have given his life kind of because the idea
meaning.
That you are Bez and then you suddenly discover that actually there's an entire whole of Ibiza actually exists because of Bez, the god of. I mean, as I said, it just seems too perfect to be true.
It's a great irony.
And you have Carl from Madness plays
Raoul Hausmann, who was one of the original Berlin Dada artists, one of the best, actually. You know, the image that kind of defines that time is that wooden head with the antenna, which is almost prophesying what's happening with us and the internet, you know. You know, when Hitler got on their case, he was also Jewish. He wasn't just a degenerate artist, he was also Jewish, so he had to get out. And he went to Ibiza, which I was saying was so remote that you felt vaguely safe, I think, there. But Hitler sent Hitler Youth there. And another irony, to spy on these guys and report back what was going on. But another irony of the island, you know, is after the war, Franco said it's, you know, it's open house for Gestapo officers on the run. So, you know, the refugees who'd been Jewish artists from Hitler were then replaced by Nazi officers, who were there until the early 2000s, you know, making ecstasy on their farms. Later on in the they had illegal ecstasy factories on Nazi-owned fincas. Yeah, amazing.
It's like a science fiction film. I mean, it is like something that, as I say, you say at the beginning, you need to be very careful because myth and, you know, and fact are intertwined, but the actual truth of it is really fairly extraordinary.
Yeah.
And it somehow seems that there's a reason why Ibiza has become this this kind of, you know, cultural mecca. On the one hand, fantastically real and genuine, on the other hand, fantastically artificial. On the one hand, you know, free and hippie, on the other hand,
it's all about the money, you know.
And the, how do you, is it, how do you pronounce the guy's name?
Matutes,
who literally runs or owns. I mean, at one point you speak to an Ibiza resident. So yeah, he owns Ibiza, but they don't mind because he's made it wealthy.
Yeah, I mean, well, I think there's an interesting split now that how wealthy do you want to be if you lose
everything,
you know, because money in the end doesn't mean everything. So in the end, that's at the core of the film. You know, I wanted to make it about their story rather than just about the clubbers. But I wanted the clubbers to know the kind of place they were going to, and I wish the clubbers would dance a bit more.
Tell me about
it's another message of the film.
Tell me about working with Norman Cook and how he was involved in it.
Well, as you know, I've fessed up to not being a great EDM kind of expert, so I needed a guide through this thing, and I couldn't wish for a nicer bloke than Norman. I mean, really, really helped me, expose me to 5% of the best stuff that I could work with and tell the story through. And I love the soundtrack, actually, even though I'm not a natural fan of the music. I think he's guided me into choices that people who don't even want to go near the idea of clubbing can actually dig the feel of it.
Well, incidentally, that is me. I mean, wild horses wouldn't drag me to a club, but I really enjoyed the film, and I felt like I actually understood it as well. And I think that's always the key to a documentary: is can it involve you in a world about which you do not know anything?
You don't want to go necessarily.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. And and I really did feel like I did kind of understand, and it made the dance culture contextualized. It made it seem like it was part of a longer
evolution.
Continuum.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I did understand that, and Norman really helped me understand that. I mean, Norman is very connected to Glastonbury as well as Ibiza. I think those are his two favourite places, other than Brighton, on the planet. Maybe Rio. But he's not just your normal Ibiza EDM DJ. This is a man with history in all sorts of different types of music, and is engaged with Brazilian music and Cuban music and places I've been to, and I think we got on really well in telling the story in using that music as a narrative force. It's kind of unstoppable. The psychology of that music is powerful. The way they build to something that completely breaks, and the tension's going, and you're inside a cage kind of editing. You've got this cage of rhythm. So you can go crazy like some lunatic trying to bash his head against the cage. You can go off the beat, you can be on the beat. Yeah. But it's got this very kind of like regimented, it's unlike other music to cut to, but it's actually quite interesting to cut to it. Because you do things you don't expect to happen, because everything seems to be predictable, but then you can go against that.
In another absurd coincidence, at what point did you discover that Sid Vicious had spent time with it? Because again,
I always secretly knew that.
Did you? Oh, did you?
Because I was in, inside information.
So you always knew that Sid Vicious.
I never divulged it before now.
I just thought, again, this is too good to be true, because you directed Rock and Roll Swindle, and there we are suddenly seeing clips of Sid Vicious doing Come On Everybody on his motorbike, because there's a Sid Vicious Ibiza connection.
No, when everyone said, I was really excited about Orson Welles, Sid Vicious, Raoul Hausmann. They were saying, what the fuck are you talking about? This is about clubbing on Ibiza. No, it's not. Because Orson Welles, famously made that beautiful movie, which the Rock and Roll Swindle was inspired by that. Again, blurring myth and reality, Malcolm McLaren was the puppet master. Bullshit. The day after the Grundy interview, he was like, the night of the Grundy interview, you've blown everything I fucking work for. You've destroyed everything I've done for you. And Paul Cook comes in the next morning with 15 national newspapers, dumps it on his pillow. Well, Malcolm, look at this.
But did you? Did you get the sense of the forces lining up? Because I know there's a lot of spiritual baloney, but the fact is there are too many coincidences. I mean, the Sid Vicious thing, okay, you knew about it beforehand, but it's like the F for Fate connection, the Sid Vicious connection, all these things, it's almost like this movie.
Well, drones falling out of the sky. My drone, we were trying to film that henge, that new age henge. Of course they have on Ibiza.
<Of course. laughs>
Like Spinal Tap.
Yeah. It's not an island
without
a henge.
We were flying this drone and suddenly it smashed into one of the henge pillars and this thing coming up, you know, magnetic overload, and the myth is, you know, Esvedra is the most magnetic. It was right. So I don't know. There is something weird about the place, and something very beautiful in the soul of the place, which is why I kind of like to see the film as a kind of intervention when you've got like a brother who's a bit out of control and needs to deal with it.
Yeah.
You know, I think Ibiza needs to look at itself. And by Ibiza, I talk of all the people who go there and love it, and as well as the culture that it comes from, you know, about everybody involved. They need to really look and wonder whether they want to go further down this path or they want to keep something of what the place was. I was very struck by all the big demonstrations last year in Barcelona saying we must not become Ibiza, we've got to keep our culture, we can't be kind of written out of history by just allowing tourists to swamp us away, you know. And it's difference that's important in the world, you know. Inside cultures, but different cultures need to keep individuality. You can't, you know, the idea you fly to wherever and it's the same place, it's a nightmare. You know, the airport's the same, the roads are the same, the restaurant chains are the same. I mean, that is the end. You know?
I have to tell you that one of my strongest memories of you is going through airport security with you, because you have a...
Moroccan Tuareg bracelet.
That cannot come off.
No.
It
went on at 16 and my hand was probably shrinking now.
So it's a bracelet around your wrist. It was put on when you were 16 and it's metal, obviously. So every time you go through airport security, it goes off and you have to literally explain to them that it cannot come off. And I thought they're not going to let you on the plane, but of course they did. I love the fact that you've actually...
It reminds me who I am, this thing, because I have to get searched.
Every single time. But there was part of me that thought that's very you. There's a pride in being unable to go through any security without that setting an alarm off.
Right. I want them to know who I am.
Do you stay friends with the people that you make? Like, do you still see Wilco? Do you still see the Pistols?
Yes, I still see Wilco. The Pistols are in LA, so I haven't been there that much. John and Steve, I'm really close with. Paul, I'm close with. John's a bit of a, you know, hasn't aged that gracefully.
I heard him on a radio program saying that he thought Trump was an outsider and he could, and I just thought.
Lost the plot, mate.
Yeah. But Wilco is now.
He's 72, yeah, and he's had another 4 years of really, you know, playing his heart out. He's played better than he ever did, I think.
And what an astonishing experience to make a film about somebody who was in the end of their life saying goodbye to it,
right.
Who then miraculously wasn't. I mean, it is the most extraordinary story.
It was very, very strange. Yeah.
And again, you couldn't have made it up. If somebody had pitched that as a fictional thing, you would have said, "Don't be silly."
Oh, I couldn't believe the day he told us that he had this news. He said, "You've got to come down and film me. I've got some really good. We're making a film about him saying goodbye to everything." Go down, and we get there, and he's asleep. Can't wake him up, you know. So we had to wait like 8 hours. He finally wakes up and comes to the place we've been waiting, which is the famous Dr. Feelgood down by the jetty seawall. He turns up and says, "I've got a chance, I've got a chance." It's like, great, sit on the wall and tell us about it. But it was funny. He was asleep for most of the day.
After the first screening of that film, there was a gig that he played at the 100 Club that I went to, which was brilliant.
That was brilliant. He was shamanic there.
And there was a guy who was, you know, right very close to him with a camera, right, taking the photo. Somebody went, "Who's the guy taking the photographs?" And he went, "That's his doctor. That's literally the guy that saved his life. He can stand wherever he wants."
Yeah.
Because he was so full of life. I mean, it was the most energetic. I saw Feelgood in the 70s, you know. It was the most energetic I'd ever seen him.
Right.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it was amazing. One thing I was thinking when you were talking about animation in terms of the Abita film, because when I was a kid, you know, animation was something Walt fucking Disney did, not people like you and me. But now it's affordable, it's usable by anyone, really. So, you know, the idea of silent movie captions can be completely transformed by what you can do on a laptop with graphics and you know, pasting things together and animating them. And I find that, you know, that's, if we're talking about how you make a silent movie, that's also another, you know, we've got 7.2 sound, but we've also got the ability to do stuff with the captions that, because when I was editing this, no one got it. You'd suddenly cut to a bit of printed black, you know, text on black screen, and it was like killed the vibe, killed. I was saying, it's going to be better than that. We're going to animate it. We're going to do some graphics. Nah, it's not working, mate. You know, this is not going to work. But actually, you know, you can do a lot for little money with animation and good graphic designer. Yeah, it's amazing.
So you fired up for the Glastonbury premiere?
I am.
You're going to be there, obviously.
Of course I am.
Are you going to watch it in a car with the headphones on?
Yeah, I've got a nice 53 Buick lined up. With dodgy windscreen wipers if it rains. It's great in the rain because you've got this kind of great Cocteau-like, you know, visual effect of the rain running down the windscreen and big, huge screen in front of you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Very glad to say that Norman Cook is here. Norman, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
Big fan of Ibiza the silent movie, despite the fact that, like, as I was saying to Julian, what I know about club culture is nothing, and I've never been a dancer or anything, but I thought the movie really worked and got me inside it all. How did you... Go on.
I was going to say, is the correct answer?
Yes, it is the correct answer.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with this?
Somebody asked me, Julian, I don't know if it came directly from Julian, somebody suggested it, and I basically leapt down the telephone line, leapt down Julian's phone and said, I'm the man for the job. Simply because I've always loved film, and was always looking for a way of getting into it, actually working into it. I've always loved what Julian does, and his style very much echoes, I think, the way I make records, that kind of cutting and pasting of different, juxtaposing different things and found elements. So, and then obviously Ibiza is kind of my second home, so I know it inside out. And so, yeah, I just leapt down your throat and told you I was the man for the job. And
Yeah, Julian said he needed a guide. He needed somebody that could explain dance music to him. So how did you go about explaining to Julian what this was?
I don't think I really needed to explain. It was more. I tried to lead him down the path of righteousness. There was a little bit of reduxing. It was more pointing out things that didn't work. It was more things that Julian, like tunes where I was just like, you know what, that's never been played in Ibiza.
Okay.
That doesn't fit. So it was I don't know, just leading by example. I mean, some of the first filming you did was at my shows, and if that didn't drop you in the deep end, I don't know what would. I think it's interesting, the musical story, because you have to have been there,
which is why
I liked your comment about if people don't really understand club culture music, it'd be really easy to alienate them by making a film which just went, you don't get it, this is our thing, this is our gang.
Yeah.
But the idea was, for Julian was to tell the whole story and to introduce everyone to it. So it wasn't, we didn't want to make it just for Ibethan clubbers or for people who'd been there.
Yeah.
But there had to be something in for them to learn a history lesson about the history of the island was great. Yeah. But in terms of music, it was to invite everybody into what, because a lot of people have preconceptions from like Ibiza Uncovered or just their friends' tales of stag doos or whatever, of what actually goes on. And it was, you know, there's subtleties in the music that sometimes get lost.
I love the way the music works throughout the film, and I do think that the definition of any good documentary is that it can make you understand and be interested in something that you didn't understand and weren't particularly interested in before. In terms of the way in which the dance culture that exists seems to come out of thousands of years of history. I mean, with this weird coincidence that Bez, which just seems like something somebody must have made that up. Did you know any of that before?
No. I mean, that was the first of many, many facts. But that's the one that just blows your socks off. And probably, I'd love to see Bez's face when it was pointed out to him. Though he might have been told before, like on the dance floor at Amnesia or something, and just went, yeah, funny. But historical facts, that. That's kind of sums up, for me, the whole film. The idea that what went before begat what is happening now,
yeah.
Whether we know it or not, and there's bits of it that tie in, and there's themes that have been recurrent throughout the island's history, and it's almost spooky the way that history repeats itself.
Yeah.
And it's how we got to the Ibiza that we know today, rather than just banging on about what it's like.
There's also this lovely thing about it being a silent movie, because I play in a band that accompany silent movies. Silent movies is my sort of big obsession. And I think that it's a brilliant idea to have that movie in which, because silent movies were never silent, they were always accompanied by, they were always musicals effectively. And actually what you've got now is a musical. It's not dialogue. It's something in which the entire story is told by music. It's a perversely brilliant idea.
This man wrote the book about perversely.
DJ's an alien. He's messing with our minds. The DJ's an alien, and he's messing with our minds.
Julian, when we started, bless him, he really loved the idea that you could dance all the way through it.
Yeah.
But obviously that would become quite monotonous, and also the story goes off in twists and different directions, yeah, where you don't really want to dance,
yeah,
to certain,
yeah, dancing to the Nazis would be,
so that was the only bad bit, the only bit about my part of the job that I didn't,
springtime for Hitler.
Well, yeah, fair enough.
The only bit that I didn't really fulfil, probably what Julian wanted me to, was make a soundtrack that you could dance all the way through, but that's, you know, the story was more important than the dancing.
But a brilliant idea that it will premiere at Glastonbury in this kind of, you know, this extraordinary setting with this huge screen and people listening. I hope there's a real perfect synergy to that film and the Glastonbury Festival, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean,
you're in both places, aren't you?
Well, we've both got history. Well, yeah. I've got history with both. So for me, they feel like they're almost twin-towned. But I don't know. I mean,
Glastonbury twinned with Ibiza.
I think you have some idea that we were going to premiere it by projecting onto the rocks at Esvedra or something.
Well, I have mad ideas.
But no, I mean, Glastonbury, as outside of Ibiza, probably Glastonbury is the most obvious place to premiere. Yeah.
I remember, this is ancient history, I saw you playing bass in the House Martins years and years ago when I used to be at a magazine in Manchester called City Life.
Right.
And we promoted a House Martins gig. This is back in the 1980s. And I've always thought that it's really interesting that a bassist in a band became, because I'm,
yeah, I was going to say, I was just about to tell you that, as you know, bass players are always the mostly stable,
crucial element,
the crucial, the most,
the driving
and
force,
sexiest.
Yes,
obviously.
Exactly. Yeah. So I was just actually going to offer you the opportunity to just wax lyrical about how bassists actually rule the world for a moment.
Well, you know that.
No,
bass?
That is
the question.
Something about it. Is all about the bass.
It is, yeah, I mean, I joke about it, but we are generally the sexiest, the most well-balanced, the best timing, mm-hmm, and the best...
The Sid Vicious connection there.
Did you know the Sid Vicious Ibiza connection before Julian started doing this documentary? Because again, I thought that was something that he must have made up.
No, I didn't. It was one of the things that you knew before.
True, you know.
Because a lot of the other stuff was you just researching and then hanging out on the island? But that was one that you knew.
I knew personally, yes.
Yeah.
And did you feel that watching the film was in it, did it teach you stuff about Ibiza that you didn't know? Because you've been such an integral part of that dance culture. Did you learn stuff from Julian Stott?
Absolutely. I mean, everything pre-1950, the Phoenicians, the Romans, the Dadaists, the Nazis, that, most people who go to Ibiza don't think about things like that. They don't think that it ever existed, you know, beyond the end of their nose. So, yeah, I mean, all the historical bits. Yeah. And then... No, I mean, to be honest, I know Julian jokes about, you know, all of this is true, and, you know, the fake news side of it, but most of it is actually true, and most of it, a lot of it is stranger than fiction, and a lot of it is stuff that we just didn't really delve into more. Because the worst thing, if when you sort of suggested the film to me, it'd be, are we going to interview you, Pete Tong, Paul Oakenfold, and Alfredo, and everyone. It's like that story's been told. Yeah. And that story's kind of the same bits get repeated over and over again. Whereas Julian dug so much deeper and earthed some fabulous stuff.
Yeah.
For me, that was it was looking back to beyond giraffe dodgers and hippies. Anything beyond that was all news to me and yeah, but all made sense. It all made total sense. Of course, that's why that was, you know. And tying it in with water. Tying in with water, the idea of people escape, running there to escape. So many themes just keep reoccurring.
The fact that it's right on the cusp of these two separate cultures, that it is, I mean, it does seem to have been perfectly placed geographically to become this kind of this focal point. Do you feel positive about the future? Because the film ends on a slightly cautionary note, which is, you know, we have to take more responsibility for what's happening. Do you think, has the moment passed, or is there a good future?
I think there's a good future there. I mean, this might sound contentious, but Ibiza has been invaded by so many different people, and in between sometimes there'll be kind of fallow times. I think what's happening at the moment with the VIP culture might mean it goes into decline a bit, but it'll reinvent itself in a different way, or a fresh bunch of people will invade.
Yeah.
So I don't think it's the end of it, but it's worrying times. I mean, that's again one of the things that I think is really brave, that Julian didn't pull any punches about how he feels about what's going on, because a lot of people are like, oh no, we don't talk about that, you know, it's going to affect, it's a bit like Jaws, it'll affect the tourists. And so there, you know, but the yeah, there are things, there are issues that people worry about where the island is going. But even if it does destroy the kind of current VIP culture, then the country will go back to the salt economy and then wait for the next invaders.
And there isn't the sense anyway that the VIP culture is something artificial, but actually, as far as club culture is concerned, that's not where it comes from. It comes from a much more kind of working class base. It's people who can afford to go there.
Well, I think over the years there's people who went there because it was really cheap, and then they attracted the movers and shakers and the beautiful people, and then when they ruin it, then it goes back, and that's kind of one of the sort of cyclical things. It's kind of the people with the money follow the people who haven't got the money.
Thanks for listening to this Kermode on Film podcast, and our thanks to Julian Temple and Norman Cook. You can see Ibiza the Silent Movie at Glastonbury, and then it's on release from July the 5th. And like all of Julian's movies, it's a trip. And I say that as somebody who has firstly never been to Ibiza, and secondly never understood club culture. But as with the best documentaries, it made me interested in and more knowledgeable about a subject about which I previously knew nothing at all. And that's a top recommendation. So thanks for listening to Kermode on Film, and thanks for making it a million plus downloads hit. If you haven't done so already, please subscribe and tell your friends. Keep watching the skies.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch? Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.